Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. It is the 22nd of September, and it's a great pleasure to have you all with us. We have a great panel. I'm very excited to talk to the group about what is going on today, and we also welcome you, of course. That's part of this program, is to include your voice. All you have to do is write to us. So it's your voice through my voice, if that makes a sense. You write the letter, and then I'll read it. So it'll be your words. It'll just occasionally sound like me. Anyway, panel at WAMC.org is how it works. Panel at WAMC.org. We can't get to every letter, but we'd love to get to as many as possible. To do that, just keep them short and to the point, and we'll all be good. Panel at WAMC.org. As for the makeup of the panel, we begin with WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm fine. As you know, I don't really believe in the death penalty for humans, but I do believe in the death penalty for mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And when I was taking my walk, but there will be somebody writes in and says, wait a second, the mosquitoes were here before you were, Alan. Don't be arrogant. But no, I try to kill as many as I can, particularly the ones that are on my face or arms or hands. And when I was out for my, 5-mile walk this morning, I think I killed a lot of mosquitoes, and that's good.
I guess that's good. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
It was very good.
I mean, it would be better if they were doing their thing and not bothering you and no insects were hurt during the walk.
Yeah.
But, if they got to go, they got to go. We welcome Rosemary Armeo to the program, an investigative journalist, a adjunct professor of journalism at the State University of New York at Albany. Good morning. Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I just realized I'll get yelled at by the university because it's University at Albany, and when you say it any other way than that, they get all touchy.
Yeah, that is important, isn't it?
So, good morning. Welcome. Speaking of said University at Albany, Bob Griffin is with us. He is Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Cybersecurity at the university. And, he doesn't care how I say it, but he does work for people who do. So good morning, Bob.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's great to be here. And, Alan, today is the fall equinox. So if you're just a little bit patient, I'm sure Mother Nature is going to take care of those mosquitoes. And, Joe, today is also Hobbit Day.
National Hobbit Day.
Those mosquitoes, they don't respect our calendar. So as long as it's warmish, those mosquitoes are going to be here.
But first frost, they're dead, right?
But I have to say, I always listen to the guy who is in charge of emergency preparedness because that includes mosquitoes.
Yeah, we don't want that to happen. You know, Bob, I was thinking of you because I went to go get coffee this morning, and I was filling up my cup of Joe, and I looked down and they said Wednesday, September 22nd is National Coffee Day, and I said, I wonder. At least I think it was today. I don't know. I saw Wednesday. I didn't have my glasses on, to be quite frank. But I said, I wonder if Bob will bring that up.
Yeah.
But I like hobbits better than that. That's good.
It's also National Chainmail Day, too, which I still don't understand. But I figured I'd share it with you anyway.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. All right. We've already had a listener that has just buzzed that said it's actually the 29th is National Coffee Day. So I'm a week ahead. I apologize. Yeah. Look who's here.
I want to talk about chainmail.
Why do you want to talk about chainmail?
Because I'm reading Game of Thrones and everybody wears chainmail and boiled leather.
I need
to find out what that is.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Were you a fan of the TV show or are you just reading the books?
It was my retirement project. I'm watching all the shows and reading all the books. It's fabulous.
Good for you. Yeah, that's a good project. We welcome Cohoes City Director of Operations, Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing well, and happy fall to all. And Alan, you just need one of the hats with the nets around it, and then you're good.
Yeah. We got a guy who walks in our neighborhood with that. That's right.
Yeah.
And then Roselle found something you put on, you just attach it to your shirt or whatever, and it repels them.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
It works for mosquitoes and bees and any kind of bugs.
That's very cool. I know
the thing over your head?
Well, those things that now I think they're including in watches, too, in the Apple watches, where it'll make that sound that'll keep the mosquitoes and flies away.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's worth a lot of money.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, Teresa, sorry to hear. I know, Congressman, I think a sad day for all of us in this region, but Congressman Sherwood Bullard passed away. And I know you had some dealings with him, and I know, Alan, of course, you did.
And he was a good guy.
A really good guy, and 84, I believe. And so a sad day. But, Teresa, what are your recollections of Sherwood Bullard?
He was what I would call a quiet giant. And he was a Republican in the Congress for 24 years. He chaired the House Committee on Science for several years. But the progress we've made on acid rain can be traced back to the leadership work he did. He was an early and strong advocate on climate change, on reducing greenhouse gases, and protecting the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, a lot of environmental focus, you know, leadership early on, and also university-based research. He was a strong, strong advocate for university-based research and finding pathways to get good ideas out of the university labs and into the, you know, to drive innovation. And most of all, I think on a day like today with all the news about the legislative wrangling that's going on, we need more people like him because he was strongly focused on compromise. He understood that, you know, he was a Republican, but you had to work with Democrats, you had to work across the aisle, and to actually get things done. So he didn't make a lot of headlines, but he did a lot of work, and he will be missed, and he's a model that that other people should follow. And I know, Alan, I'm sure you had much more direct contact. I just watched him from, you know, across the room with great admiration when I was working on the House side and on the Senate side. Mm-hmm. He was just terrific.
Alan? I love talking to him. He really was magnificent.
Well, Sherwood Bullard passed away, and we remember him this morning. I want to get to a lot of subjects here. There's a lot to talk about. Of course, the big one is the possibility the House passed a bill, which ultimately is looking to avert a shutdown, but it's going to cause a lot of problems as well. This sort of goes on, you know, what we were talking about yesterday, but the House passes the bill to avert the shutdown and suspend the debt ceiling, but legislation obviously faces grim prospects in the U.S. Senate. Democrats and Republicans are very far apart ahead of key deadlines that could unleash economic havoc. The high-stakes feud stems from a fight to raise the U.S. government's borrowing limit, known as the debt ceiling. Democrats have tied the increase to a bill that funds federal operations into early December, setting off a war with Republicans who refuse to raise the cap out of opposition to President Biden's broader agenda, even if it means grinding the country to a halt. No recent fight in the halls of Congress has quite carried the same stakes as this one, coming at a time when Washington continues to grapple with rising coronavirus infections and the deadly consequences of a fast-warming planet. Biden himself has warned about the catastrophic effects of inaction, with key deadlines looming. With a clock ticking, the House took the first steps on Tuesday to stave off the political and economic crisis as Democrats voted to keep the government operational and suspend the debt ceiling into December of 2022. The party line outcome foreshadowed its doom and the prospects of doom in the Senate, where Republicans have pledged to oppose it, threatening to leave Congress with little time to resolve a set of disputes that could destabilize global markets. Nancy Pelosi said, "We cannot shut down the government. That would be catastrophic in its own right. We cannot ignore and not support the full faith and credit of the United States of America." With that, we go to Alan.
Well, I'm going to predict that they're not going to let the country fail. That may mean that they have to pass two separate bills as opposed to putting them all together in one. But it is really, can you imagine going into the 22 elections if you're a congressional candidate, a Republican particularly, and you say, "I voted against keeping the government solvent," and because a great deal is to be lost here. If they stick to their guns and they really mean it and they're not going to do it, a lot of people are going to get hurt. A lot of people aren't going to get their checks. The government will fail in so many ways, and it will cost probably billions of dollars, which can't be spent, and spent on things that people need. And as far as the politics of the situation go, I want to pass to Teresa, who really does know her congressional politics pretty well. What do you think?
Well, congressional politics, but also I would assume as a director of operations of a city, this has great consequences for, you know, where your money comes from, doesn't it?
Yeah, we are watching, from the city perspective, we are watching this very, very carefully because there's a lot of hope in this infrastructure bill for us and also in the larger bill because of the clean energy provisions in it. And, you know, it's possible you could end up with a lot or nothing. And we have, we're trying to implement a floating solar, generate all of our energy for the city with clean energy, with solar on our water infrastructure, and funding for that is tucked into these bills. You know, we have 1895 water, you know, sewer pipes and water pipes, and just like a lot of other, you know, cities all around the country. But from a perspective of having worked in the Senate and worked through several government shutdowns in the 80s and then more so in the 90s, this one, as they're reporting, is different in the sense that if you shut down the government, what happens when you shut down the government in the midst of a pandemic, when the government is such a leader in addressing the problems of this pandemic? What happens when you don't have a deal for money for disasters? You know, you have Ida that struck from Louisiana all the way up to New York and, you know, New England. What about the fires in the West? You know, they're apocalyptic is some of the words that have been used, and in some cases that's hyperbole. But I think in this case, particularly when we're in the midst of a pandemic, it's pretty serious. And Alan, I think something you said I think is so critical, which is everyone is arguing, the Republicans are saying this is too costly to pass these packages. But what is the price tag of allowing the government to shut down and of disrupting our economy? And we might spend more money on that than we would in passing some of this legislation.
Bob.
Yeah, Joe, I agree with a comment that was made by Senator Kennedy that this is a manufactured crisis. It really is. I'll also note for our listeners that this same language wasn't used when Trump was pushing his enormous giveaway to business and the rich. It seems like we didn't talk about the debt limit during the Trump administration. So once again, we're in this position where the political gains of a few are outweighing the good for the rest of us, the common good. And having lived through government shutdowns in the past, I can't do justice to how bad the cascading impacts are on the federal agencies. Right. Even a week pushes so many timelines back. It disrupts all of the workings of government to the point where it'll take months and months and months to recover, if it ever does recover. I have said for a while that I felt that there should be a constitutional amendment that freezes all congressional pay and benefits until a budget is reached, so that if we're in a situation like this, the members of Congress actually feel the pain like the rest of us do.
I believe I was going to go to Rosemary, but I don't think we have her. So
can I?
Yes, please.
You asked about the politics, and I think that the thing that's interesting to me is what hand is Senator McConnell trying to play? I mean, clearly his overall goal has been to take back control of the Senate because they want to control taxes and they want to control judges. But the question is he willing to damage the economy to get there? And will he pay a price if he, in fact, does not have any Republicans voting on raising the debt ceiling? Because that, you know, all the experts on all sides of the aisle understand the potential quote-unquote economic calamity, which is what people call it, of doing that, the good faith and credit of our country. Now, everybody says at some point somebody's going to blink, but the question is how far is he willing to go? And on the other side, Senator Sanders and some folks on the left, you know, they see this as their moment that they can create some big, massive change, that everything's aligned for that, and they don't want to back down. But are they willing to end up with nothing in their quest to get everything? I think that's the fundamental question. And I go back to Congressman Boehlert. You know, he understood that the goal here is always to create a bill that everybody's unhappy with but willing to vote for. And they're willing to vote for because they've compromised. And I'm not sure if some of the people on the right and some of the people on the left are willing to compromise.
We do need to pause there and take a break. I think we got Rosemary, you're back, yes?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
back.
Great. So hold on, and we'll get to your comments on all of this when we return. First, we have news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, and Teresa Bourgeois talking about the House passing a bill to avert shutdown and suspend the debt ceiling, but the concerns, of course, that legislation faces grim prospects in the Senate. Rosemary Armeo, your turn.
My turn. I think the Republicans have smelled a victory here, and they're taking a gamble, and they're going to not support infrastructure, and they're not going to go along with this attempt to pressure on the debt ceiling, and they're going to just hold out. And the Democrats' only real recourse is now, as it always has been, dumping the filibuster and proceeding with their minimal, little lousy, kind of not even one vote difference, just the vice president's. And they don't have it because of two senators who disagree with even dumping the filibuster. So I think they're playing a game of chicken. It's a game that everyone's blaming all of the legislators for doing this to us once again. Everything Teresa said is true. And how many freaking times have we heard it in the past 3 years, 4 years? It's used, the debt ceiling is used as a ploy to get passage of some other bill, and then it gets down to who's gonna blink first. And it's annoying, and it's terrible governance, and they all equally deserve blame, I think. I said it when we first heard that the Democrats were going to pair the debt ceiling with this. And I don't think it's going to work. I just don't see how they have the traction to make this work.
I could use either party in asking this question, Bob, but let me just say, how good are the Republicans at blinking?
I think that given where we are in our political climate is that there's a lot of people that benefit from not blinking no matter what the situation is. I read that Ted Cruz is going to filibuster. And for him, like DeSantis and Abbott and others, is that they're willing to drive the country into the ground for their own political gain. So I think where we are today is that we're less likely to see compromise than we would have been in the past. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I hope calmer heads are able to win out. But I agree with Rosemary. I think that this has a different feel to it, and that there's going to be a lot of pain before we're through this. Unnecessary pain, too.
Teresa?
How is that considered a victory for the Republicans? I mean, the debt ceiling is something that more and more people, these guys have gone to the edge on, but not crossed the line. And remember, the Democrats three times under Trump joined with the Republicans to raise the debt limit. And they were doing it, to pay off the Republican tax, changes. But they did it anyway because they understood the depth of problems it causes the not just the U.S. economy, but the global economy if you don't do it. And so how is McConnell making that calculation that this is anyway potentially a win for him? That's what I don't understand.
If I could jump in, Joe, I think part of what they're thinking is that if they could slow down the economy right before the 2022 congressional elections, that this is going to be placed at Biden's footsteps and therefore the Democrats. I think that is definitely playing part of the equation.
Here's
I worry that that's true, but my goodness, you know, that's a really dangerous calculation in the midst of a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Here's what
it is dangerous, and I have to tell you, Teresa, in the end, you also have to look at the individual careers of the people at stake here. So now we see McConnell in a major battle that is playing out between him and Trump. So if he can take the more Trumpian side on this one, it may be a calculated risk for him that it will work out that some of the conservative Trumpian Republicans will think better of him. His ratings, by the way, his polling ratings are absolutely terrible.
So here's Joel's perspective, a listener, who writes, "This is how democracy dies. The 535 people in the Congress gridlocked in a game of chicken while 330 million people suffer. Fertile ground for an authoritarian strongman to proclaim that I alone can fix it. Here comes Trump," which is pretty much just what you were saying, Alan.
Yeah, could be.
Well, Trump has his own personal financial... Sorry to interrupt you, Alan.
Go ahead, please.
I mean, somebody shared a story with me the other day about Trump's, his business finance, the financial state of his own businesses. And people, you know, look what he did to the country and look at the financial state of his businesses. But this is about so much more than former President Trump. I mean, the potential harm to people's retirement accounts, people's pension accounts, people's day-to-day, you know, what they buy at the grocery store, the economic impact of not raising the debt limit. I know it's, you know, boring, but it's important. And of not continuing the government in the midst of a pandemic is pretty complicated and expensive, and it will have immediate impact on people's lives and on their pocketbooks.
You were talking about...
Go ahead, Rosemary.
You were talking about men who stood by while democracy was under assault, while states that needed unemployment and better wages and Medicaid and Medicare, while they just stood by and refused to let it happen because it would make Democrats look good. So I don't think the importance of the debt package, I definitely don't think the 501k of millions of Americans is going to make any dent in his thinking at all. McConnell is thinking, he's probably not even thinking about Trump. He is in a catbird seat, and he's thinking about continued power. He is the master of how the Senate works and how to use his power in the Senate to control politics overall in this country, and that's exactly what he's doing. And I think Schumer wandered into this fight with him, tying the debt ceiling to this infrastructure bill that he is dedicated to defeating just to hurt Biden and to improve Republican chances in 2 years, less than 2 years now, is paramount in his mind, and he will accomplish it.
But do you think that the Louisiana senators are going to hold, given the amount of funding in these bills for their hurricane relief?
Well, Kennedy said that he would vote for it only for the relief, and he hated it. It was horrible. So you might get the Louisiana vote, but can't he afford to lose it? McConnell can afford to lose that one vote. So yeah, I think he's got it all figured out. I don't see how the Democrats can pull this off, and I don't know how they thought they could pull it off.
Well, that was what I was going to ask. Of the strategy, I like the term that you use, that Schumer wandered in, Rosemary. So sort of like, you know, came to a knife fight with a
pea shooter. compared to the minority leader, really, he's a piker.
Bob,
you know,
go ahead, Alan.
You know, we faced this before many times. And it isn't as if they're not playing chicken until the very end. And it isn't as if there are, let's face it, the Democrats saved Trump's hash on this very, very issue. Now, it may well be that the idea of tying them together is repulsive to the Republicans, in which case there can be a compromise and say, okay, we'll do a separate bill for each. But, you know, I think it's... I think it's de rigueur, and I don't think we can make any assumptions yet about the Republicans going leading the lemmings over the cliff.
And Alan, look at the polling on the infrastructure bill, and ask Republican governors and Republican mayors and county execs what they think about the infrastructure bill. They're all clamoring for it.
But,
let us go back to the many things that Americans are clamoring for if you look at the polls, and that would include gun control, and it would include help for the elderly, and it would include tons of things, reproductive rights, that we are not only not getting, we're losing the ones we have. That's not the way our system works anymore, that what the people want is what happens. It's not majority rule anymore.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I don't know for a fact, but I would surmise that Schumer was using the debt limit as a mechanism to try to move the infrastructure bill forward.
Right.
Because there was a timeline that it created a pressure. So in his mind, that this may have been a mechanism to try to unstall the infrastructure bill. It's just now it seems like we're going to lose everything.
Do you think he was wrong to do it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
I do. I think Congress should have already passed legislation that moves us away from the question of whether we're going to pay our debts or not, so that we don't play this chicken every time the debt limit comes up. But no, I do think that this was a mistake.
Well, we'll see if he's, you know, wrong or brilliant. But it also gives the Republicans a reason to vote for it, and my guess is that enough of them probably want to vote for it because they know their states need it.
Bobby Rosemary, you were going to say?
I'm definitely in the category of Schumer erred. He underestimated the determination, as Democrats typically do of Republicans. They play really, really hard ball. And I think that McConnell will do anything to stay in power and increase his power. And that includes bring us to the brink. Also, you know, this whole thing with debt and paying back our bills, look at how fluid the Republicans have been. When it's Obama in office, it's like, oh, my God, look at our debt limit. We're going to be pariahs in the world. Then Trump gets in and they just blow the debt limit, out the sun. They just increase debt by trillions, and it's no problem. It's fluid. It's not the catastrophe that even you're painting here, Teresa. If they default, the entire world knows that it's politics and the U.S. has the money to back it, and they'll be given a pass. And I think everybody's playing with that. It's we're using end of the world apocalyptic language, and it isn't. It's just money. And Donald Trump is the master of this, by the way, which is why he does all these disreputable, immoral, bad business things, practices, and yet he's still very wealthy and lives like a millionaire today. They're playing the game, and it's odious, but they are winning.
All right, let's pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a couple of letters I want to get to, and then we'll move on to other subjects as well. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, and Teresa Bourgeois on this morning's program. We'll continue after this break. Beautiful little ditty called Cat Walking on the Piano. good morning. Welcome back to the program, and it's very nice to have you with us. We have letters. Let me get to some of those. And we go to this one from Anthony. When was the last time we had a reasonably predictable cooperation between Congress and the president? Was it Ronald Reagan or George H.W.? Not to couch my question in party politics, but the obstinate posturing started when? ? Was it with the definition of is, and a bigger question, is what will it take for America to find itself again? Lots of questions that only seem to grow deeper with time. In the wake of Sherry Bullard, this is a sad era to send him off from. That from Anthony.
Boy, there's a whole bunch packed into that letter, isn't there, Joe?
Yeah.
I personally would sort of look at the Gingrich Congress as the point where we started to see the real deterioration. I know you could probably make a compelling case to go back to Reagan, but really, I think that the Gingrich gang is the point that I look at. The question that I think is deeper, more philosophical, and probably even more important is that how do we come back together as a country? And I'm struggling with that. As I said a couple weeks ago about 9/11, is that it was the one point in my life where I really felt like the country had come together, regardless of political position. And I certainly hope it doesn't take that type of event to pull us back together again.
Teresa?
I want to point out real quickly that Gingrich lost his job as a result of this. So it's not as if he started a revolution. You know, so I think, you know, they have to walk a little bit more gently as individuals to protect themselves.
Teresa?
Well, I was working in the Congress during the Reagan years, and I will tell you there was a lot of animosity. Now, certainly Speaker Tip O'Neill and the ranking minority Bob Michael worked well together, but there certainly was a lot of brinkmanship and rancor and disruption. But I do agree that Newt Gingrich, I mean, I'm not a historian of the Congress, but I do know that Newt Gingrich really crossed some lines and created a dynamic that almost forced his other members to join him in crossing those lines, which set a tone and set us on a path that has been pretty perilous, I think. But one would hope that we understand that we're in a bit of a different situation right now as we deal with this pandemic and its threat to public health and its threat to our economy. And shutting down the government in the midst of a pandemic, I don't know if there's any precedent for that, but it could have some really deep and serious consequences, which I would hope that these folks, as they come up to the brink of the decision, are thinking through very carefully.
Adam writes, Teresa, I'm a fan and not worthy, but I want to challenge respectfully your compromise comments anyway. I agree that Bullard's style of compromise was the best kind of conduct when all negotiators are acting in good faith for the sake of the union. Rosemary is reading Game of Thrones. Anyone who has read the series knows that one bad actor can tip a nation into civil war. Wars are fought on paper now. The Pope just referred to some of what is happening here in the U.S. as works of the devil. The massive changes proposed by the left are the required interventions for the sake of the union. For the sake of the future, we can't afford to make a compromise that reinforces the self-destructive status quo. I like that letter because it brings in so many threads of what we were talking about. Good job.
Good letter.
Yeah, it's a really good letter.
I do love that letter, but I also think about back to when I was working for Senator Kennedy and we were trying to move a massive health care, you know, fundamental change in the health care system. And we didn't. We got it through the committee that I was working on, but not Senator Moynihan's committee, and ultimately not through the Congress. But then they went back to work the next day, and we got Child Health Plus, and we got a number of other changes. And they were incremental, but they laid the groundwork for ultimately President Obama getting the full package. So, you know, rarely big things happen. More often, a whole series of little things that create change. And my point is, it may or may not be the moment when a big thing will happen, but we should not sacrifice and end up with nothing in the quest for everything.
Let us go.
Jeff, if I could just jump in. I'm in such complete agreement, and my concern is that that there's folks on the left also that will that will tank the infrastructure bill. And I think the infrastructure bill is absolutely critical to our future.
Right.
And I struggle with the fact that, I mean, this should be a unanimous vote. I understand differences of opinion about the amount of money, but we need infrastructure work in this country desperately. And I do worry that that we're going to end up with nothing.
Rosemary, you were going to say?
I support that position that, well, that Bob and Teresa both espouse is actually the Republican position, that we can't do a big major bill. We should do something incremental. And it's just how incremental is up for debate. And Democrats so far are saying, no, we want the whole thing. We'll shut down the country if we don't get it. So are we in favor of the Republican position?
Well, I actually think it's right now how big it is really a fight between among the Democrats, and I echo what Bob said, and I think that's what I was trying to say when I started out with it's the issues are on the side with McConnell, but it's also between the moderate Democrats and the Bernie wing of Democrats, and I think everybody would like to do something big, but the question is, what can you get through, and is there in their effort to get everything, will we end up, you know, house of cards falling in on itself, get nothing, and even not get infrastructure? So I think you have to work, and hopefully today President Biden has a whole series of meetings at the White House with a variety of groups, and I think Speaker Pelosi's a master at figuring out how to thread these needles and count votes, and I think Senator Schumer also understands what's going on both on with the Democrats and with the Republicans and their who's up for election and what their needs are, and hopefully they can thread this needle. But I'm with Bob. It would be dangerous if we end up with nothing.
We got this letter from Mark who says Republicans are better than Democrats at using the debt ceiling limit as hostage because they are not invested in government programs and their hard line plays well with their base. Democrats can't threaten to vote against the debt limit when Republicans pass deficit busting tax cuts because they do care about supporting social programs that their base demands. Alan.
Well, okay. Well,
okay. Okay. All right. Is that an okay, I agree, or yeah?
Well, okay. There are differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. And the Republicans are certainly not for social spending. We know that. So so that when these kinds of fights come along, they have a little bit longer stick to fight with because the Democrats are fighting for things that are going to help a lot of people in this country. The Republicans are not on that side. So they have something else going for them. What do you think, Rosemary?
Yeah, the letter stated what I've been trying to articulate. He did it better than I did, that they are masters at using this debt ceiling as a weapon. You know, they've weaponized it. And they don't care. They really don't care if the government shuts down. And as I said, I'm not sure that even other, if you don't work for the federal government, do any of us care? It doesn't really impact us. You can't go to the post office. Okay, the post office is awful these days anyway. Maybe it's less of a weapon than it used to be because they've been overused.
Well, you better listen to Teresa. You better listen to Teresa, who's on the firing line.
I know,
go ahead,
she's
Teresa.
Idealistic. So she'll tell us all the reasons we should care, but I'm just saying we don't.
Yeah, but she's got a city to run.
Yeah,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think that the common line about who cares about the government anyway, and it doesn't make any difference if it shuts down, is what people think before they start thinking about the details of it. And in a pandemic, when it's the CDC that's making these decisions and collecting the data and sharing information about outbreaks, who's going to be tracking the variants? Who's going to be conveying that information back to these Republican governors? Who's going to be dealing with the issues about the hospital overflows and how you shift people and resources around? I mean, there are just so many layers of areas where the federal government's role in healthcare, in research, in data driving, you know, the response to this are critical. And then the basic economic, you know, flow of business, if the Commerce Department shuts down, or climate change, fires, you know, weather. People don't think about where do we get our information about weather and weather patterns. We get it from the federal government, from the Commerce Department. You know, Bob, do you want to take over? Because I'll go on and on.
Well, actually, I'll pause all of you, and we'll get to Bob when we come back. We have to take a break, and when we do, we will we'll continue on this subject. We have more letters, and then we'll move on to other things. Good discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, and Teresa Bourgeois, we welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back. First news with Ray. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, and Teresa Bourgeois. Very nice to have you with us. We have letters. Let's go to this one from Jason, who says the very functionality of corporate America depends on a robust infrastructure, yet their reluctance to pay their fair share in taxes and their owners, like Bezos, not paying taxes makes it impossible to pay for without loading up more debt. Got this one from
Joe.
Yes,
Joe. Can I just? I think it's really important too that we talk about what the debt ceiling pays for. The debt ceiling isn't paying for current spending or proposed spending. It's paying for spending that we have already done. So I mean, this is the, in my mind, sort of a simplified equivalence of saying, well, you know, I bought my house, but I'm not going to pay my mortgage. And you've already done it. I mean, so you've already committed to paying that. So I don't, you know, when we're starting to talk about spending in the link with the debt ceiling, it's a lot more complex than that. And the other comment that I want to make back about the earlier section,
yes,
is just think about how messed up the supply chain is right now. Anybody who's looked to try to get a vehicle, and there's chip shortages, and it's going to get worse. You shut government down, there will be a slowing, because you won't have the robust customs and border protection dealing not with the border but necessarily but with trade. So the government is funding an awful lot of a lot of private industry that is going to be on the sidelines. So it is a big deal. Initially, if it's a couple of days, all you're really going to see is, well, the parks closed and the museums are closed, and they'll do the story they always do about the family in Iowa that saved their entire lives to go to the Smithsonian and is closed. But the longer impact, particularly when you start to get into weeks, is a real drain on an economy that's already very, very fragile given COVID.
Teresa, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I want to echo this. I mean, the focus initially is always on the panda cam, and I, you know, I'm a lover of the panda cam at the National Zoo, and I hate to see it closed down. But and if you haven't gone and looked at the panda cam,
save the panda cam.
Okay. Well, actually, it turned out when we were during the Clinton administration, when there was a shutdown, that one of the things that my job was to figure out what the issues were that were affecting people's lives, and it seemed the thing that people were most concerned about at one point early on was the panda cam, which I love it. I love looking at the pandas. It's very calming. But
I mentioned that to one of my classes years ago. I mentioned about the panda cam, and they didn't know what I was talking about, so I brought it up on the screen, and for 4 painful minutes, we just watched the panda lick itself.
I'll leave that there.
Anyway.
But Bob is exactly right. If it goes more than a few days, you know, particularly if sometimes they try to schedule it on a Friday so they can work it out over the weekend and have a solution by Monday. But it's very, very complicated. And I also think, Bob, your point is correct. And I think people are blurring the difference between the continuing resolution that funds the ongoing government and the debt ceiling. And for a while now, Congress has been tinkering and fighting about the continuing resolution and the bills that fund the government, and that's why we've seen the shutdowns. But there has been great hesitancy to tinker with not raising the debt ceiling. And it's a very different thing, and it's paying off our bills, and it's damaging to the economy if you don't do your duty and deal with that.
Let's go back to... Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, McConnell made the comment on the floor that he railed against the Democrats, and he said something about reckless taxing and spending spree. Actually, what the debt limit's going to pay for is his reckless taxing and spending giveaway that was done under the Trump administration and before. So, yeah, it's it is being convoluted.
Let's go back to letters. This one from Chris. Gingrich openly advocated for Republicans to treat Democrats not simply as wrong in the issue or just on the other side of the debate, but to treat them as evil. It was also couched in the evangelical movement, pitting Democrats as evil and servants as Satan. Then, I'm trying to figure out really how that's changed, but Greg says, hello, panel. Who cares? I care. I do not want to see my 401k implode 8 years before I would like to retire. Mitch needs someone to tell him how many Republicans are getting to retire over the next 3 years. Anybody like to address that one?
He's right.
Well, one wonders whether the difference in how much money the Democrats, the average Democrat and the average Republican have come into play with all of this, don't you think?
Teresa?
Well, if you're suggesting that the Republicans are wealthier,
I am.
You know, they're going to be more concerned about their, you know, the dive down in the economy, a deep drop in the economy, but in fact it's going to impact the lower income, you know, middle income workers more, particularly those who are on the verge of retiring because they have, you know, less money and less time to recover. But you just wonder why. The only thing I can imagine is that McConnell is assuming that it won't get blamed on just the Republicans. It'll be a pox on all their houses because people won't, you know, they won't know to blame. The Republicans will just blame everybody.
I'm sorry to be so contrarian here, but we have had several shutdowns recently, and I have a 401k, was never impacted by the shutdown. There's the fear of a shutdown. There's all of the wonks of the world telling us why the continuous payment bill and the debt ceiling are separate, but both important. But they do not have an impact on our life. You just can't convince me of that.
Well, listen to Teresa.
It's all maneuvering in Washington. She's great and she's right, but it does not. The Republicans are using it as a weapon, and they know that people like out who are not Teresa don't know all this, and it does sound scary, but it really doesn't happen. It never happened. All the times Trump shut down the government longer than anybody else. It didn't impact my 401k. Not a penny.
What about what we're seeing?
The debt ceiling, though, Will, if they don't raise the debt ceiling and that roils the markets, that can potentially have a pretty significant impact on your 401k.
The market roils all the time, and as soon as the government comes back, it all goes back to the way it was. It's a temporary roiling. So,
yeah. All right.
Go ahead.
And some people play it. You know, some the Republicans, those in the, who have money to do this, play with them. They actually make money on government shutdown. So all of this it's the fear of a government shutdown that is supposed to make this a weapon. But they've used it so many times, and we see nothing really happens, that it's not as powerful as it used to be.
And I think this is part of the problem with the federal government is that it doesn't do a good job in explaining what it does for folks. So, you know, when you see potholes in your roads and you're blaming the local government, some of that is because transportation money isn't flowing back to the state, which isn't flowing back to the local government. But there's a gap. You know, it takes time for that impact to hit. The other thing that I find fascinating about the conversation, and I think I really want to throw this into the mix, is the very senators who are fighting this are coming from red states who gain more from our tax money than we do in New York. You think about New York and California and places like us, we send tax money to places like Alabama and Florida and Mississippi. And I sometimes I just can't believe the cognitive disconnect that Those senators are actually voting against the money that's going to their own people.
Right. And the other thing is a big fight over this, the big bill, you know, the not the infrastructure bill, but the other bill, the $3 trillion bill, is the pay-fors, you know, how you're going to pay for it. And the early on discussion among the Democrats is you're going to pay for it by just having people pay the taxes that they owe, particularly the people at the top level of the economy paying the taxes that they owe, not necessarily raising taxes, but just doing a better job at collecting taxes so people pay the taxes that they owe. And what's interesting is the Republicans are totally opposed to that, which is fascinating. If people just paid the if the wealthy in this country just paid the taxes that they owed, we could address some of these issues.
All right, let's go back to the letters, and there are many. And then I do want to get to other topics today, so I'll go through them quick here. Number one is from Gary. We are just seeing deja vu all over again. The Republicans cut taxes and accrue a deficit and then fight the Democrats both on dealing with the deficit and raising taxes, all part of the Republican delusion of economic growth through inequality. Then we go to Denise. Schumer has argued that Republicans should cooperate with Democrats to raise the debt limit because Democrats voted to raise it three times under Trump. McConnell's refusal should throw into question whether Republicans will retain the filibuster if they take Congress and the presidency. What better way to jam through their anti-democracy agenda once and for all? Question mark.
Well, Alan, I think you've spoken to this before, haven't you?
I have many times.
That McConnell's trying to bait the Democrats into changing the filibuster so he doesn't have to do it, but he can benefit from it?
Yes, and I don't even think it's a matter of baiting. I think he'd do it in a minute if he had to. And I think the Democrats just, I know the level of frustration. Believe me, I get these letters and I understand them. Nevertheless, if the Republicans take the Senate and the Senate, because, of course, there is no filibuster in the House. If the Democrats take the Senate, you know, I have no feelings except that they will use it like crazy to do whatever they want. I think those who want to end the filibuster now are making a short-term serious mistake.
I agree with you. I think that we should hold off on that.
All right, let's go back to...
It's all moot because you can't pass, you can't get rid of the filibuster. You don't have the Democratic votes to do it. And it seems to me the Democrats have already lost. They already are doing everything the Republicans want, even in the majority. And I don't know. McConnell has, excuse me, all of the cards are on his side right now. Yeah, Mitchell's better. McConnell has all the cards going on his side now. I love the idea that Schumer goes, well, you know, we did it for you. We played nice three times, and we raised the debt ceiling, so you got to do it too. Yeah, just like he didn't push Amy Coney Barrett through because he already screwed us once. Yeah, they play dirty. The Republicans play dirty, and the Democrats never learn. Stop playing with them.
Bob?
But this is the Trump debt, though. This is the Trump debt.
I actually agree with Rosemary.
Yell back! That's how that works.
I was gonna say, you know, this scenario is that in the second half of a Biden administration, if another Supreme Court seat comes up, and McConnell controls the Senate, you know that I'm sorry, that's a horrible analogy. That didn't work at all. Never mind. I was just saying that if McConnell has a chance, that's true. He would get rid of the filibuster to put more people on the Supreme Court, is what I was trying to say, in a really horrible, convoluted way.
But the Democrats have to say over and over again to the Republicans, you voted for this debt with your tax package. You need to vote to pay for it.
Come on, that's not the way they act. Teresa, you know it and I know it. I mean, we get a lot of letters like this. The Democrats,
this is what they should do.
The Republicans need to realize they don't care. They just don't care. And they are banking on the fact that most of the American people have no understanding of what you're talking about.
I mean, that's what basically you're saying, Rosemary. They don't care. I mean, they're playing dirty. They don't care. And if you know, there's blood on the floor at the end, so be it.
Right, but the question is if they... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think
go
she
ahead,
was...
Go ahead. You need to hear more light.
L-I-G-H-T. Go ahead.
The question is, are they going to pay a political price? Are the Republican senators from states that were hurt by the hurricane and need the funding going to pay a political price if they don't support the bill that has the disaster relief in it?
With the possible exception of Louisiana, the answer to that question is no. They don't care. They don't know.
Even
they don't
in
care.
Louisiana. Even
what'd
in
you
Louisiana,
say?
They're going to say the Biden administration didn't give us money. They're not going to say, oh, our guy didn't vote for it. That's just not the way we use accountability in this country. We blame the presidential administration. It'll be on Biden, even though it's not his fault, the same way the bad economy, if we tank the... paying our bills and we can't handle the pandemic correctly. It'll all be on Biden, and he's a Democrat.
Well, I think Republican mayors
and
Republican governors.
Even though FEMA had no money to give.
All right, let's go through everybody. Alan, you were going to say?
No, we do know that in Louisiana they're taking this rather seriously, and that may be the one case because they have so much to lose right now. What with the, you know, the leavings of the hurricane and everything else, most people are not involved. We've said it 1,000 times. They don't follow it. They don't understand it, and they're quite cynical about it. And I think, and I'm not after anybody here, but I think cynicism is what will kill this particular cat.
Meaning.
No, I'm not going there.
No, but I mean, meaning like how to set us.
Well. If Rosemary says, and I, I love what she says and what she adds to this panel, but if in fact she says, cynically, but people don't care and the rest, and it doesn't mean a thing, it does mean a great deal. And if you listen carefully to what the people like Teresa are saying here, who has a city to run, we will be screwed to the wall if we don't have this money. And I think that's true. And I've heard an awful lot of economists who are talking about that. Rosemary, you're up.
No, I've said, my views, and they just are not changing. I know it's serious, and I know that the Republicans are to blame for this, but I don't think many of my fellow Americans know or care, and that the Democrats have once again been maneuvered into a position where they stand to lose everything right now, far more than just the temporary keeping the government open. They tend to lose Biden's vision for the future, which I actually believe in. And I think that that's on the line, and I just don't see a way out of it unless there's some change by two Democratic senators. They're not even using advantage of the slim majority that they have.
So Sean wrote to us, he loves the panel, and says, regular people are nervous, not about social issues, but about stores being half empty. The cost of gas, the cost of living. The only prices going down are hotels and lumber, which the average American don't use a lot anyway. Even Democrats are getting pressure to separate the bills. That is from Sean.
I don't see any reason why they can't separate the bills, to tell you the truth. I think I agree with Rosemary, if I understood what she said on this, that, it is a cheap political gamble. The Democrats have done it several times. Let there be a compromise, and the compromise would be, we'll agree. Our conferences will agree to pass both of these, but separately.
So, Mary has a question for Bob, who earlier said, "How do we come back together as a country?" Mary says, "Do Republicans and their base want to come back as a country? If not, what do they want?"
Well, it's a good question. I'm assuming the better of people, and maybe that's a mistake on my part, but I still think that there's an opportunity for us to be a people and to live up to the ideals that we sort of hold dear in the country. So I do I do think there's enough sane folks in that, that vote for Republicans that, that love the country and will support the country over party. So I am a little bit hopeful there.
And I think
I don't see, I mean, what scares me though is that the leadership, the way the elections go, is that, that they're pulled to the far reaches of the party. And they're more and more extreme, and we're putting people in Congress who are absolutely, frankly, incompetent.
And they're governing based on primaries as opposed to general elections. Yeah. But also, I think we can't lose sight of the fact that there's some hard questions for Republicans right now, but there are also some hard questions for Democrats. And Democrats are going to need to compromise among Democrats to find a way through to this. For each of the three things that needs to happen, which is, you know, basically you have three different things. You have the infrastructure bill, you have the continuing resolution and the bigger package, and then you have raising the debt limit. And the question is not only what are the Republicans going to do, but internally, how are the Democrats going to work together to find the right pathway through that they can put enough votes together to not just get something through the House, but get something to President Biden's desk that's signable?
All right.
That's very wonky. I'm sorry. But.
No.
And no, your point is really well made. And as long as all three of them are linked together, all three of them are going to die by the combined weight.
That's why I wasn't the immigration decision by the parliamentarian the other day, I think, was, you know, it's that was just an anchor that was too heavy for those bills. To add immigration onto everything else would have been too difficult. But, you know, there was a proposal to add immigration right to the legislation moving through, and the parliamentarian said it was not germane. You couldn't do that. And I think that would have definitely been too much.
Garrett writes, so if they don't abolish the filibuster, fearing what a GOP majority would do with it, what does it really avoid? If the GOP takes the Senate in 22 or 24, won't they have the votes to abolish the filibuster anyway? Then, go ahead.
Exactly. Yes, that's such a good point. Yeah. That's why if the Democrats could, right now would be the time to get rid of the filibuster, pass through voting rights, which is, you know, dead in the water, pass police reform, pass infrastructure, and then let the Republicans do what they will. But they can't. Even if they were to get rid of the filibuster right now, I don't think they can pass any of those or most of those measures. So really, that's why I say the Republicans have it. They can sit and do nothing, or they can agitate, and they're still going to win. It's so maddening.
Let's see. Red state senators. Ricky writes, Democrats are blowing it. Don't wait for Republican senators to be humble that their states receive more in tax revenue than they pay in. Rich corporations don't and will never voluntarily advocate to pay their fair share of taxes. It's up to the Democrats to be tough and make them pay. Dems are too namby-pamby by over and over and over and over again. One more letter, and then we'll take a break. This one from Jules. I don't think that concern is the question is the pandemic a concern? I don't think that concerns about the impact of the pandemic have any place in McConnell's mind or strategy. That's pretty evident in deep red states lagging vaccination rates. Republicans are happy to walk over the bodies to attain their political goal. And Alan writes, fact, the U.S. has never, ever defaulted and would do so only by congressional decision to do so. It could pay all its debts this afternoon by sending a digital deposit to every debt holder account. Money supply of the moment is irrelevant to all of this. And I think I can squeeze this one in. Kitty writes, we've already heard how Republicans will frame every issue when Mark Molinaro used his press conference to talk about Afghanistan. Unfortunately, none of the people who vote as Republicans will hear about the catastrophic consequences of opposing the infrastructure bill. I'm going to write both Manchin and Sinema and remind them of all the tourism money I've spent in their states and ask them to think about risking those out-of-state dollars. With that, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We'll wrap up the program with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters. Last chance for those. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our final segment of the panel portion of the program this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, and Teresa Bourgeois making up the group. And we welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. Okay, let's move on to other stuff. So, should the Taliban attend the UN General Assembly in New York? The Taliban seeks to attend the General Assembly. They want to send a high-ranking official to a gathering of world leaders this week at the General Assembly in New York, according to a UN official, an indication that the militant group seeks legitimacy on the world's biggest diplomatic stage. The Taliban sent the request to the UN Secretary General and a message that named Mohammad Sahel Shaheen as the group's permanent representative, according to a UN spokesman. A senior State Department official said the Taliban request would be taken up by a credentials committee that includes the U.S., but did not preview an outcome. Alan.
Yes. Of course we should. I mean, you know, we've had political enemies and philosophical differentials. The UN is supposed to be, and, you know, some of these people are reprehensible, including the Taliban, by the way. But I think, you know, the UN is a place which, if it's achieved, if it has achieved anything, it is at least a place where people can come and talk and hear each other. So I'm for it.
Bob.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have a leg to stand on here. We negotiated with the Taliban as if they were the government before they were the government. So I'm in complete agreement with Alan. They absolutely should be allowed in. Again, I don't support them or their positions, but, you know, I don't know how you can say no now when we've been doing so much work with them in the past couple, you know, past year.
Rosemary.
Well, I'll make the argument for the other side. Why don't we let North Korea in? Because they're repugnant and warlike and don't really deserve the status of one nation among other nations. So I'm not sure that our position is consistent. I think I would actually be in favor of having everybody in, but again, if you're not going to have North Korea because we don't like them, if you're not going to have Myanmar, why would you let in the Taliban?
Well, let me try to answer that. I think you have a very good point. But it seems to me that so far that this is not the old Taliban. They're talking a different game here. And there's generally consistent feeling that they want into the international community, both for its money and whatever else it can lay on them. So I don't think it's the same. I don't think North Korea is the same as what the Taliban are telling us now that they are.
Anyone?
No, I think you're right. And I think North Korea, you know, have been part of the United Nations in the past or had opportunities. They decided to forego that to continue on with the development of their nuclear weapon program. So it is kind of an apples and oranges, although Rosemary, I agree with you. I think that any government should be allowed to attend. Otherwise, there's no opportunity to have any constructive conversations.
Teresa.
So I'm not sure I'm informed enough to make a judgment, but when I read this, I thought of Sun Tzu and the Art of War, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Having them at the table, I think, has some benefits, but also does it send signals. But I was intrigued in that article. There was a paragraph that I was fascinated by. It says the Biden administration recently asked the United Nations to waive a travel ban for the Taliban, but a senior U.S. official said that request was made to ensure the Taliban leaders could continue to travel to Qatar, where they've engaged with representatives of foreign governments, and was not a request to allow the group to travel to New York. So if they have they're sitting around the table to negotiating in Qatar, why not in New York City? I don't know what's the difference, but I think it's all very interesting, and I'm fascinated by the travel ban, which I did not know was in place. So that's a long-winded
well,
way of saying
exactly
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure they could do this, but it's... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Sorry,
no, she was done. Go ahead.
I was going to say that
I don't know if the UN does this, but if they had conditional membership, that might be interesting. For example, you have to put a woman in on your team in the UN. And, you know, why not? The U.S. has used its UN membership ambassador as a ghetto for women on a cabinet for years. So it would be nice to have a Taliban woman on.
Interesting point. Let's see. We have a few moments. I want to go to the story about the treatment of Haitian migrants and the allies of the president getting very upset over this, and rightfully so. We talked about this story on Monday, but as more details and as the situation continues, and perhaps most disturbingly, we see the pictures and video coming out, it has become more of an issue. Democrats and civil rights leaders expressed outrage today toward the Biden administration's treatment of Haitian migrants in response to images and video of U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback chasing down and blocking migrants. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and the majority leader speaking from the Senate floor, said that the images were completely unacceptable. He said that the administration could not continue these hateful and xenophobic Trump policies that disregard our refugee laws, adding that asylum seekers must be afforded due process. Representative Benny Thompson, a Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, echoed those comments, calling the images horrific and disturbing. In a statement, Derek Johnson, the president of the NAACP, also compared the practices of the Border Patrol agents to the inhumane immigration policies of the Trump administration. So, the White House did not immediately respond to a request, but Vice President Kamala Harris on Tuesday described the images as horrible. She said she planned to discuss the matter with the Homeland Security Secretary. Alan, it seems like that's a huge problem on their hands.
I think that it is a huge problem, and I think it's quite clear that this is a repulsive situation to so many Americans. I mean, if you're going to train Border Patrol people, and if you're going to train police in cities like New York or other places, and that's what this year has been all about, then you train them well. You train them how to do it. You don't tell them that it's okay or even imply that it's okay to ride a horse, pardon me, to ride a horse and hit somebody with a baton from your horse. It's just too much for most people to understand.
Rosemary?
Well, I think it's appalling, and I think that those Border Patrol guys have been out of control for quite some time. Trump empowered them as extra powerful force, used them, you know, in Washington and all that. It's time that they are disciplined. Haiti is another situation. I hate that it's being portrayed on the right as an invasion on our southern border. You're talking about maybe 15,000 desperately poor people trying to escape political chaos and gigantic natural disasters in Haiti. Why is it so horrible that they want to come here, and why are we treating them like outlaws? It's appalling. I hate what it says about our country. And what can Biden do now? Because he's going to be held to blame either way, for Democrats for not helping migrants and by Republicans for allowing this so-called invasion on our border. So he should just do the right thing. He's deporting a ton of them right now. That's probably what he has to do. It's not what I would like to see happen. These are people who really do deserve or should at least be considered for asylum. And those border policemen have to be not just investigated, but disciplined. That was horrendous. Get rid of those stupid horses.
Get rid of the horses. Bob.
Well, I'm not going to blame it on the horses. But there's a couple of points.
Yeah, hold your letters.
No horses were hurt in the making of this panel.
Our Haiti policy has been messed up even before Trump, though. We swing wildly from being supportive to being prohibitive. And so our Haiti policy is something that really needs to be clarified. Also, a couple points for folks at home. You know, Customs and Border Protection is actually the largest police force in the country. And the head of CBP who has been nominated is now tied up in the Senate. In fact, I spoke with folks this weekend who told me that they're not sure that the appointment's even going to make it out of committee, which means that for both CBP and for ICE, Immigration Custom Enforcement, there will not be an appointed head from the Biden administration running those organizations. So I think a lot of the changes that need to be made in both of those organizations are going to be dependent upon both congressional support and getting nominees in place. And until you have both of those elements, these two organizations are going to continue to act in ways that I think are in contrary to our ideals.
Teresa.
Well, I agree that those scenes are deplorable. But I think we're a nation of immigrants. They can't reach consensus on immigration policy, and there's been a stalemate for, 30 years or so. And this raises a number of questions for me that, you know, what is the right way? What's the safe way? You want to treat people humanely, but you want to do it in a way that doesn't signal to come, because if they come, they're going to be on the border in a way that it's not healthy or safe for them. You want an orderly mechanism for immigration into this country. And so how do you do that? And then I think about the Trump administration hollowed out the State Department, immigration services, and you know, what is the state of those departments now? Are the enough people in the right places to make decisions and to handle the processing? You know, the court backlogs are years long. I mean, it's a really complicated series of things that end up with a deplorable photo like that. But behind it is a lot of chaos that's really, you know, not caused by those people on those horses. That's not excusing them, but I'm saying it's really complex, and the leadership has punted on this for way too long, and you have these humanitarian crises keep happening.
And Joe, if you think about then layering on top of that, this idea of a potential closure, which is going to take all the attention from the brass, because they're going to be dealing with what has to be closed. This is why the earlier conversation about the closure of government is so important. It's an element that we don't normally see as your sort of average American people, but it makes this complex problem even more complex.
Rosemary, I'll give you the last word. We have it in a minute.
Okay, we keep hiding behind complexity, and I agree leadership all the way up to Biden and our senators are at fault in immigration, but I do not at all excuse the guys on the horses. This is like the guards at Abu Ghraib who were torturing Islamic prisoners. They didn't need special training or some sort of morality lesson from their leaders to know what they were doing was wrong. That was wrong. It was horrible, and they deserve the criticism they're getting. I want them punished. I want them. They shouldn't be on the force. This is not someone who should be dealing with immigrants.
All right, we're going to end there. My thanks to everybody and for all of your time, as well as your very insightful thoughts. Alan Chartok, thank you so much.
Hey.
Hey, right back to you. Rosemary, Bob, Teresa,
thank you
all for being there. We'll be for being
Happy Hobbit Day.
And right back to you, Bob.
Great panel.
We'll be back right after this.